While we're interrupting, can I do something terribly rude?
Yeah.
I'm making some bread, and I have to, for like 1 minute, go and turn them all. So
go for it.
Like, for 1 minute, I'll pop over. Great.
Go for it, Matt. Grant Sanderson from the YouTube channel 3 Blue 1 Brown was our guest on the first ever Number 5 podcast. And today, well, he's back. In recent weeks, Grant's made some fascinating videos about the coronavirus pandemic. And even more recently, he started live streaming lessons for high school students who are stuck at home. He's doing really interesting stuff during what you could perhaps describe as the most interesting of times. Here's our discussion. So you were in the first ever Number 5 podcast, and you're back.
I had the honor.
You had the honor, and you're now back. You're not the first repeat, though. You're not the first person to make a second appearance. I'm sorry. Hannah Fry beat you to 2.
As well she deserves to. I mean, I would listen to a podcast with her and her alone, if that's how you want to steer this thing.
So when I think of 3 Blue 1 Brown videos, I think of meticulous preparation, sometimes months and months of preparation, carefully plotted animations that have been like hewn from nothing. Like, that's kind of like your calling card. And now you're doing something a little bit different.
If this is not the polar opposite of the usual style, I don't know what is. In short, I'm doing live streamed lectures. So one is different because it's live, meaning instead of taking 1 month to produce a video, you know, it takes 60 minutes to produce a 60-minute video. Second, it's live action. So I'm like on camera, pencil and paper. I'll have some animations, but just as like the occasional thing that I pull up if it seems relevant in a screen capture.
Yeah.
And then also it's like directly targeted at high school students, which I aim for most of the videos to be, you know, as approachable as possible. But realistically, I know the demographics, like the majority, it's 18 to 24 year old or 24 to 30 year old. So it's like the college students and the yuppies. So it's like, all right, I'm going to shift format, do it live and target it at an explicitly different audience. Let's see how this goes.
So, well, okay, then let's deal with the more obvious things first. Why? Is this because of the lockdown? Have you sort of seen this need all of a sudden? It seems like everyone's creating educational content for kids who can't go to school. Was this precipitated by that? Was it something that was in the works anyway in your mind? Why are you doing this?
It's definitely the impetus. And, you know, the stated reason, which is not untrue, is that you've got a lot of people who are students who are doing some kind of distance learning, and I want to add a resource that's helpful for that. If I was a teacher, maybe I'd want to like point the kids to something where I don't have to like come up with how to fill their time in this weird situation. But if that was the only factor at play, I probably would just be doing the normal video style. I think for a while I felt that it might be nice to just do something totally different, especially pencil and paper, just because while I love to animate stuff and visualize it, that doesn't feel like doing and discovering math to me. That feels like presenting an end polished version, right? Whereas just sitting down in a scrappy context with a notebook, like that's what doing math really feels like, or a blackboard, or chatting with someone. So having something that I produce actually be representative of that feeling and just working through examples. It's like, sometimes it's unsexy, but you know, let's just plow through this algebra. I've had a thought that that's something I kind of want to do. And then the other factor that plays into it, which is probably the straw breaking the camel's back and like making this happen. I have a good friend, one of my closest friends I used to work with at Khan Academy, named Cam. He's building this product called Item Pool that's aimed at just being a centralized resource for basically question and assessment items and things. And then he together with another person many listeners might recognize the name of, Ben Eder, who does a number of things, but among them runs a YouTube channel about computer engineering, have been like tweaking that particular tool to be like useful in like this sort of live stream context, kind of as a way of launching the product slash just getting some usage and being an excuse to like get what he wants made, even though it wasn't originally envisioned as, oh, this will be a tool for live streaming YouTubers. We think that can actually be a fun way to make this a more engaging dynamic. Anyone who watched the first stream might kind of know how the first experiment of that turned out, but maybe we can talk about that later. Those three things together, though, are kind of why I'm doing this.
Well, seeing you brought it up, Grant, let's talk about this new tool that your friends have devised that you're incorporating into these live streams, because I know you had some teething problems when you got the hug of death from the internet on your first go, but I did watch your sneaky behind the scenes test run that you invited a few people to come and have a look at.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, yeah. I know you just did a brief tweet, so not many people saw it, but I did see it, so I went and had a look. So I saw it working quite well, which I'm sure it will be working well again soon. And I thought it was like a fantastic addition to this kind of live streamy, you know, Khan Academy style watch me write on paper thing, which can sometimes be a bit, you know, you either love it or hate it. Mm-hmm. But I thought the incorporating of this interaction and the questions was a real winner. So do you want to kind of explain to people how you see that working when it's working at its best?
Absolutely. My mind was blown when Eder showed me the demo. Basically, he pulls up this video. I'm in the other room watching his like test stream. And he points me to a website that I can go to answer a multiple choice question. So the way I had it, I was watching him on the stream, then on my phone, I was on the website. And so he pulls up this question and you see it on the corner of the stream. And then you see these bars showing some statistics. And so like I put my answer in and one of the bars changes, like the action of mine changed what happened on the screen.
Yeah.
And it's showing like the first place, most common answer, second place and such, but you don't see what they are.
Yeah.
So you might see, oh, wow, like 50% of people think it's some answer, then it's evenly distributed among the rest.
Yeah.
And then he can reveal, be like, oh, looks like most people chose C. Let's discuss. But a lot of you still were saying, hey, that's a common misconception. We can go into that.
So you're kind of, it's kind of like you're live crowdsourcing what kind of your audience's opinion is or what they think an answer is, but you're not necessarily telling everyone what the answer is, so they can't jump on a bandwagon because they don't know what the bandwagon is.
Exactly. So you can know if there's consensus, but you can't know what that consensus is around until the streamer or whoever's controlling it reveals.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you this. So very interesting, you were among those 100 people who were I did the test stream with, because I basically just put out the tweet and then I waited until there was like 100 simultaneous and then deleted it,
right.
Which happened pretty quickly. The retention on that was like insane in terms of if you contrast it to usual retention on like YouTube videos. Yeah. And a lot of that might just be because, oh, it's the sneaky test thing and we're like this inner audience and like curious to see where it goes. But at the same time, I didn't tell anyone there like what amount of time to expect and, you know, just asking for like an hour out of their day when they were scrolling through Twitter doesn't seem obvious. So I'm curious to see, in contrasting the second stream with the first, when it's a much larger public audience, if having the tool there actually guiding the class as it's intended to the full time changes like how long people stick with it.
Can I ask about you? Like, because you are a guy who does talks and you have appeared on camera before, but at the same time, I guess maybe I had this wrong preconception of you as someone who likes to be a bit of a perfectionist and get everything just right and is like maybe a little bit more shy. So how has it been, A, being so front and center and your face being on screen for an hour, and secondly, being in this situation where, you know, you're going to misspeak, you're going to make mistakes, you're going to, like, things aren't going to be perfect. Sometimes you're going to muck up, because in an hour, who doesn't muck up? How does that mesh with your brain, your personality?
That's a good question. I mean, so I'm not CGP Grey to the extent that I can infer the personality type there, but I do, I guess, I when I view a character like Matt Parker and just like his live performances and such, I don't know if envy is the right word, but I have the feeling of like a kid who's like, wow, I want to be like you when I grow up. It just seems like such a compelling skill set to be comfortable in an environment like that. And I know that that's not me naturally. Certainly like the first few talks I gave, I think were not, didn't necessarily go swimmingly. So I know that's something that I want to get better at. That's one of the reasons behind this. It's weird to put yourself front and center because it's so easy to see how normal YouTubers become vain, because you're like prepping, you're like, oh, is the light right? I'm looking like, man, is my forehead really that big? Like, there's all these thoughts that I never usually have that are centered around very shallow things, right? Like appearance, or are you going to make mistakes and things? It's a little unnatural to maybe get that out. But at the same time, you know, in this, like I said, real math feels like just going through paper. Real math also feels like making a bunch of mistakes and hopefully being kind of jovial about that and working from them.
Yeah.
And if I can be a little bit more representative of that, rather than the, oh, here's the platonic realm of black background, pristine animations. If this isn't what your homework feels like, then things are going so wrong. Like, there's a potential disservice out there if I didn't have any of the raw, uncultured, just this is how it is. This is who I am, kind of up on screen out there.
Grant, do you worry, though, about the big howler? Like, of course you can write a wrong number or a wrong sign and then pick that up and go, oh, silly me, let's cross that out and fix it up. But what about that mistake that, you know, you build on over 15 to 20 minutes and it's this kind of big fundamental thing that you've taken people down this complete wrong lane? Do you live in fear of that, or are you sufficiently prepared that you think that can't happen? Or,
well, so I'll try to prep, right? I think the goal, in the same way I did that little test stream that you were a part of, that was not just for the technology, that was also just so I could practice a lesson. Hopefully, if I prep well, in the same way that if any teacher preps well, that's not super common. Hmm. It'll happen, though. I'm error prone. Everyone is. That's going to happen. I am mildly terrified, maybe, but I think there have been some other times that I've watched like a YouTuber make a video, an educational one, and then they have some kind of follow-up that is about their own misconception that's like pretty uncharacteristic. Most people don't really do that. They'll just sort of like shuffle it off as an error correction in the description, or worst case, they'll like take down the video and put it up and kind of rewrite history. But in the times that I have seen someone be like, you know what? I said this thing that was wrong. Here's what you guys told me and here's what I learned. I just found myself feeling such respect for that and recognizing like, wow, that actually was a way better experience for me as the viewer than it would have been if you just retroactively changed it so that it was always correct. So again, in the same way that I look at someone like Matt Parker on stage and say, I want to be like that when I grow up, you know, I can look at those sort of examples and say, you know, how can I try to shift things to be more comfortable with that? Because it's not natural for me, I think, to know that there will be a big mistake that leads us down a wrong path.
You mentioned sort of the vanity and the lighting side of, you know, that vlogger existence. I have to say, I was very struck by how glossy and nice your set looked and how, like, glowingly handsome you looked. What's going on? I mean, not that you're not a handsome guy, but, like, it looked really good.
No, all of that. We're doing all of this from Ben Eater's house just because there's a number of reasons, like sort of an easier setup there and such. And he's got a lot of good professional equipment. So he's got the two cameras, the overhead on the thing, the face camera with like a really good lens. He's got all the lighting and he was like finicky about setting it up. So 100% of the credit there just goes to the fact that like his perfectionism and a little bit more comfort with live action shooting translated. I'll give you an illustration of what it looks like if I do things left on my own. Okay. So when I was earlier this week, just playing around with the broadcasting software to try this out. And anytime you download new software, just kind of poke around and try to see how it works. Maybe a tutorial if you don't find it intuitively obvious. So I download OBS and I, it's like, you know, log in, punch in this key from YouTube to like hook it up to your YouTube channel. I'm like, yeah, okay. That's something I'll probably turn on later. And I'm just poking around at buttons. And then a couple minutes later, I hear from down the hall, Eater's voice. He's like, Grant, I just got a notification that 3 Blue 1 Brown is going live. I'm like, I'm sorry, what? And it turned out I streamed myself for 3 seconds as I was just clicking around. So as a public notification event, there is a 3-second video of me just like staring confusedly at a screen with like a crappy webcam, like clicking once and then clicking twice. And I changed it from public to unlisted decently quickly, but because that goes into people's emails and such, there's 50,000 people who have now just watched the 3 seconds of me like clicking once and then twice.
Nice. We'll put a link to that in the show notes.
I will absolutely. The comment section, I was dying. It's actually super funny.
Brilliant. You mentioned how you were trying to reach a different demographic, like from that kind of quite mathy, smart, yuppie type to wanting to hit school students. But I imagine, you know, you're going to hit your core audience a lot too. All the people who really, really have loved your content for a long time are going to want to watch this too. Do you worry about alienating them or them remaining your constituency and you sort of drifting towards catering to them more than the school students? Like, how are you going to ride that delicate balance?
I'll tell you what, you hit the nail on the head for what's hardest about this. My goal is to try to teach a high school lesson in a way that's unusual enough or like relates to patterns later on enough that even someone who feels like they're pretty comfortable with math or is maybe in like the usual core audience finds it interesting. The very first stream I did yesterday, it was about, I mean, on the surface, it's about the quadratic formula and difference of squares. It's like these two sort of standard things someone might need to learn. But the hope was that I could offer a little bit of a perspective on each one that is not what people usually see in school. I learned that evidently the way I was showing things is kind of similar to what some Austrian and German students learn, which is cool, but most school systems have like a different tactic. And if I can, you know, procure enough thoughts like that, where it is a high school lesson, but it's atypical enough that maybe the core audience still finds it interesting, my hope is that success. The other factor is, even when people are, you know, really into math or they find themselves like, oh, can you please go into this complicated topic or such. Like, the reality is math is hard for all of us. And even the seemingly simple stuff has just this plethora of insight to be gained if you look back at it with a keen eye. Even arithmetic, even if I look back at how to add numbers or things like that, there's always some pattern that I realized only because of math that came later on that lends a certain appreciation down on that rung. I could easily see accidentally alienating the audience or feeling this pull where, oh, was this a complicated enough topic, and then accidentally alienating the high school students it's targeted at. I think if I did my job well, though, it's definitely possible not to do that, and it's just a matter of appropriate preparation.
What does this mean for, like, you know, your standard fare, the traditional 3 blue, 1 brown video that we all know and love? Like, are you still going to be able to knock those ones out? Are you putting them on the shelf for a while you go into lesson mode? What's the thinking there?
I don't know if I would comfortably use the phrase knock them out, but I'm working on them in parallel.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's at least one more that I'll put out that's relevant to kind of the coronavirus pandemic stuff. And that, just because of the timeliness, it pulls you to work harder. But then there's also a bunch of other content that I've been like promising, or which are like collaborations in the mix, that again, I have this pull of like, well, I really can't delay this too much. So I think really it's just going to mean that I like work more hours for the next couple months, which is fine. But we'll see how realistic that ends up being.
Do you see the lessons going as a long-term thing? Is it something you're just planning to do during this kind of crazy lockdown period we're in? Or do you see it as like a new permanent part of your life, or have you thought about that?
Obviously, it's entered the mind. My thought right now is just run with it for a couple of weeks, see how that feels. If it feels great and like I'm totally comfortable just maintaining that forever and people are deriving huge value from it, I might put it on another channel just so that there isn't that pull between audience types. Maybe the higher probability case is that we let this just be like a nice one-time thing that maybe I spin it up again as like a future season one time, but it's not going to be a recurring, you know, every week I do one of these streams. But honestly, ask me in 5 weeks, and if I'm sufficiently exhausted, maybe there's a different answer.
I noticed that you're doing it at the moment. As things stand at the moment, the plan is to be doing it on Fridays and Tuesdays. Mm-hmm. Why, oh why, in your banner on your channel where you promote when people can watch them, does it say Fridays and Tuesdays and not Tuesdays and Fridays?
Oh. Wow, I never thought about that. Maybe subconsciously, because the very first one was on a Friday.
Yeah.
So in my mind, I'm like, number one's Friday, then Tuesday, then repeat.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll go switch.
It does my head in, but I don't know why. I'm not even normally one of those people, but I'm just looking at it going, Fridays and Tuesdays.
You know what I'll do? I'm going to just leave a note for myself to change that right now. I had no idea that some people could be so very finicky about this kind of thing.
I like it. And I like your answer. I mean, I did imagine that was the answer because you started it on a Friday, but I just thought it was I don't know. I just noticed it. It's just one of those things.
No, that's hilarious. Yeah.
So you mentioned, you know, coronavirus, COVID-19, the pandemic that we're going through at the moment, and you've made some outstanding videos on it, which surely everyone who listens to this has already watched. But if they don't, I'll link to it. How are you feeling about things, the coronavirus, in all ways, but I guess mathematically?
Mathematically, okay. Well, I'll tell you this. The very first one I made was just about exponential growth, where I remember looking at the data and being kind of gobsmacked by how, if you excluded China, the rest of the world was following an exponential weirdly perfectly. And it was small enough numbers at that point. I think it was like 20,000 cases outside of China that it was in the discussion, but there was this turning point between it when it was one of the common topics of news to when it became what like everyone was talking about all the time. Right. So this feels like it was before that turning point. And I was in a little bit of a rut associated with like content making. So I was telling myself, you know what? I just want to see if I can produce a video in 48 hours just to know that I can. Mm-hmm. And like pump that out. And I felt like, okay, this, it feels like a, you know, a good excuse for a math lesson. It's sort of telling people sometimes things grow more than you think they will. I was concerned that it would spread more. I was shocked by how much it ended up affecting lives, not associated with the disease, but with things like the lockdowns and like turning off the economy and all of that. If you had asked me then, what's the world going to look like a month from now? I would not have at all have predicted that my trips to the grocery store would be this weirdly apocalyptic situation where like everyone's wearing masks and like told to be away from each other. And you've got these eerily calm voices coming from the intercom telling people like what the proper protocols are. So it's weird. And it's hard to know where my head is right now, because mostly I guess I'm just kind of frustrated that testing hasn't become more widespread, because it is the case, at least as I kind of look into it, that epidemiology done right involves a much more targeted approach where you're able to like test for the cases that exist, isolate those people, and isolate who they've been in contact with. And we as humanity, since say like the 1918 Spanish flu, like we're really good actually at knowing how these things spread and knowing what it takes to stop it. And the idea of having everyone like go inside feels like a very blunt tool. There's just a cost to that, basically, where I'm obviously very pro like social distancing, and I think it's the right thing to do. But at the same time, it's hard to ignore the fact that, you know, you have more calls made to the suicide hotline that are from high-risk people, or you have like unprecedented unemployment numbers, at least in the US. I assume this kind of carries over elsewhere. You have like increases in domestic abuse and things that are not making a appearance on, you know, a central website that we can look and see these numbers ticking up. No one sees like the suicide numbers slowly ticking up because it's not as reported. I guess the second video I made was about simulating epidemics and just kind of looking at, you know, like, let's make a toy model and see what works and what doesn't. And it wasn't meant to have a conclusion per se, but if there was one, it was just sort of this like regret that we didn't have better testing earlier, because that so clearly stops things in its tracks without halting the rest of life. But the very last thing I want to make, which is less also a very atypical video, there's this illustrated explainer a friend of mine named Nikki Case put together talking about contact tracing apps and like the cryptography behind them. And I was shocked actually when I read like what is possible. And he made it all public domain, and I also kind of got his permission and talked with the epidemiologist he worked with. I basically want to do the video equivalent of a retweet of like putting that out and kind of adding some extra commentary. Because I think one thing that's going to become much more part of the discussion in the coming months than it is now is this perceived trade-off of privacy versus global health, where what you want is for it to be the case that when someone is tested positive, one, you tell them to self-isolate. But you also say everyone you've been in contact with in the last like 3 days, let's inform them to self-isolate. The traditional ways to do that would be like interviews. This would be like pre-cell phones. You just interview them, ask them who they were in contact with and find them. For an outbreak of this scale, that's just way too slow. There's nowhere close to that many resources. So the draconian authoritarian way to do it is to say, okay, seize over the geolocation information of your phone, and then we'll find everyone who is also in those locations, which some countries would be tolerant of, but like it would be like a very big violation of civil liberties in some people's minds to mandate that. Hmm. Now, there do exist apps, and I know that Apple and Google, I don't know if they've put them out, but they're working on a collaborative effort to this effect that implement something called the DP3T algorithm, where here's what it can do. If you test positive, you can tell the app, oh, I've tested positive. And then it will notify the phones of the people you've been in contact, you've been physically near, like within a certain distance of.
Is that just everyone I walked past in the supermarket? Like that sounds, it could be extraordinary numbers if I was, you know, out in a major shopping mall that day.
The papers I've read usually have a number around like if the phones talk to each other via Bluetooth for more than like 5 minutes, that's when they exchange
Okay. This
information. And what they exchange looks like gibberish. It's literally pseudo-random numbers. They just exchange a set of pseudo-random numbers with each other.
Yeah.
And then basically your phone sends out a thing that says, the holder of this phone is tested positive. And then a central database sends out something that says, okay, any phones out there who have received this specific bit of gibberish, this like weird pseudo-random numbers, if you've ever seen that in the last couple of days, what that means is that your phone was near the phone of someone who is now tested positive.
Yeah.
Because it's gibberish, it doesn't use your location. It doesn't know who you are. Basically, in all of the ways that you want, it actually protects your privacy. So to me, this feels like the only plausible end game, because we can't just wait until there's a vaccine, for very good reasons that will take at least a year. And I just would be shocked if this level of like economic shutdown could be prolonged for anything close to that long. And it's very counterintuitive, the idea that contact trace, it's such a bad name. Contact tracing feels like the biggest Big Brother thing you've ever heard.
Yeah.
Right? It has the word tracing in it, for God's sake. So yeah, maybe they need a rebrand. But it turns out to be possible to do in like a very thoughtful way. The code is open source, so people can check that it does what it's saying it does. And that's probably the last thing that I'll put out about it, because the internet is a little bit of a all coronavirus, all the time channel right now that can wear on people.
Yeah. Grant, you're obviously someone who takes an interest in, you know, the world at large's mathematical literacy and interest in mathematics. How well do you think people have understood all the mathematics that's suddenly been thrown at them? Suddenly we've got mathematical models and exponential curves on the front page of newspapers, and people who don't know anything about mathematics talking about flattening curves and looking at graphs and all these numbers. Do you think people have done well, like, or do you think people are sort of fumbling in the dark? How well do you think the average Joe has grasped that side of this calamity?
That's a good question. I have a skewed perspective, maybe because of what my like feeds will look like, but I think it's been a great boon for understandings of exponential and logistic curves. Never has the world had a clearer picture of what those feel like than now. I think it's probably been great for lending math and mathematicians a little bit more legitimacy, right? I mean, if you have someone abstractly talk about a set of three ordinary differential equations, it's like, yeah, okay, but get back to your blackboard. I'm busy with my own things. But as soon as they're telling you that this is modeling, you know, the susceptible population, the infectious population, and the recovered population, and you have someone with the communication skills of, say, like a Ben Sparks on a number file video, like thoughtfully tweaking these graphs and showing the implications of different parameters, I think that can do a lot to make what otherwise seem like maybe not useless, but disconnected pieces of study actually feel relevant and remind people that even when it doesn't look like something is related to you, you never know what next year is going to look like. And it's worth making sure that the researchers in certain areas are still doing what they're doing for the times when their work becomes unexpectedly relevant.
So Grant, I've been doing a wonderful job tonight helping you promote some of your latest work. I need your help promoting something of mine now.
Anytime.
I want to talk very briefly about another channel that I do called Objectivity.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The last time I saw you, but just before everything got really serious, you were in London, and Objectivity videos, for people who don't know about them, and there seems to be a lot of those people, are these videos that I make at mainly at the Royal Society, where we pull objects out of the science archives and to talk about them. It's just for fun. And Grant came along to the Royal Society, and I think two videos ago on Objectivity, you were our special guest, and you're going to be our special guest again in the video next month. So if you want to see Grant in them, go and have a look. But how have you reflected on your visit? Did you enjoy going down into the vaults?
I loved that. I absolutely loved the experience. So it felt very like VIP, because this is places that normal people can't necessarily go, and you've got Keith there like, oh, here's a first edition Newton Principia. I'm like, are you kidding me? Because like, I was the day after, for comparison, I went to Cambridge, and you know, they've got their Trinity Library, and inside this enclosed piece of glass that you can't get anywhere near, there's this first edition Principia. I'm like, my hands were on one of those yesterday, this is nothing. Like, it was very surreal. I mean, you obviously made it a blast too with the I don't know if you want to tell people that.
Oh, no, we can. We were very naughty. So, but in the first video, normally I get things out of the archive that will pander to people's interests. So I did get some mathematics stuff out for Grant. But the main thing we got out, and the thing we made the video about, was about eyes. Because I have an undue fascination with Grant's heterochromial, sectorial, whatever it's called thing. The three blue, one brown. I always bring it up, much to his disappointment. So I got out a whole bunch of things from the archives all about eyes, and we talked about all cool science-y eye stuff.
No, it was great. And like, I love how you sort of jibed it. The implicit fact that I've walked myself into this with the channel name, right? Like,
that's right.
I'm asking for any trouble that I get.
You have no defense.
I will say it was also very interesting, right?
Yeah.
I think that like the level of artistry that people used to put in their scientific papers, hand sketching these things. Like,
yeah,
even though that was kind of meant as a joke, I came away like, I feel like I have a deeper appreciation for what it was like to write a paper back then.
Everything's cool. And I will give a spoiler. If someone's listened to the podcast for this long, they deserve a spoiler. In the next one that Grant is in, next month, he does this thing we call the White Gloves of Destiny, where you put on the gloves and you shut your eyes and you just pull random cards out of the card catalogue. And then whatever you pull out of the card catalogue, we go down into the vaults and read those documents or look at those things. And unbelievably, Grant pulled a real mathematical numbery one. Like, the chances of him pulling something that was directly mathematical was very, very slim, but he did it, and we got a real, we got a lovely coincidence coming your way.
That was fun. That was lots of fun.
It was good. It was good. So, we'll get you, once this is all over, you can come back again and put your grubby hands all over those Newton manuscripts.
I will say, actually, maybe this is more egotistical than it should be. Since I was on it and then I saw you post it, I like started poking around at the rest of Objectivity, which I should have before. I don't know why I didn't, but you know, there's lots of things on the internet. I actually loved it a lot. Like the chests one that you guys had as the channel trailer. Yeah. I just thought that was a lot of fun. So
yeah. It's a fun channel. I can't get 3 blue, 1 brown viewing numbers on it, but I love making them nonetheless.
That's the most important thing. I mean, it's like doing what you love and just making things that you love without like caring about the numbers, that feels much more important. I don't know. Like the channels I respect the most, I think, are the ones that hopefully they do like grow huge. And you know, every one of these deep sciencey, honest channels becomes like Mark Rober level. But realistically, you know, sometimes there's just the smaller niche audience. And we're saying small, like hundreds of thousands is like huge in terms of Objectivity, like subscribers and such. But that is what I think I love the most about the internet and things like YouTube, as contrasted with what, you know, cable TV has to be, is that you can have the existence of something like Objectivity or something like any of these channels that I love, that they just don't need, they don't need a huge scale to operate properly.
Well, they kind of do in the end, otherwise you go out of business, but yeah.
I guess. Yeah. Well, in this case, it's sort of fueled by your own passion to some extent.
It's a loss leader. So Grant, thanks so much for your time. Again, you can go and watch his new lesson videos, these live streams, on Fridays and Tuesdays, or Tuesdays and Fridays, whichever you prefer. He keeps people up to date with when they're happening. You can follow him on Twitter and all that stuff. You already follow 3 Blue 1 Brown. I don't even know why I'm telling you people these things, but there'll be loads of links in the notes for this podcast that you can click on to go and watch all the videos, the live streams they've already been, what's coming up, Grant on Objectivity, his coronavirus videos, and most importantly, we will link to that 3-second video of you trying to figure out how to work the software.
Yep. Thanks so much for doing this, Brady. I really appreciate helping to get the word out.
No, it's good. Always good to talk. I hope we don't spend the rest of our lives talking to each other like this over Zoom, and we get to hang out in a pub sometime in London.
So do I.
As usual, there are going to be links to all the things we were discussing in the show notes for this episode. My name's Brady Harron. You've been listening to the Numberphile podcast. You can find out more at numberphile.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back again soon.